Welcome and thanks for listening to Relational Practice, a Social Work Podcast. I'm Dr. Jodie Park.
And I'm Rose Mackey, and we're both private practice social workers, and we work in the field of child protection, out-of-home care and trauma. Today, we are recording on Dharawal and Newen Lands in New South Wales, Australia. Please subscribe to our social media channels and follow our podcast wherever you're listening to your podcast from.
Thank you. Thank you for that wonderful introduction, Rose. You're so much better at it than me. Oh, one more thing. Please send us your practice stories. Please send us anything related to practice that you think would be really good for us to read out during the podcast, or just to kind of know, or a topic that you'd like us to cover. Our email is relationalpractice01@gmail.com.
Hopefully you guys have been enjoying listening to us. Our last podcast was on supervision. And through that chat, I think we both thought the next suitable or logical topic to talk about would be professional judgment, decision making, and risk.
Yeah. It just kind of, it just flowed for me. Like when I was thinking about the different topics that we want to talk about, we've got a whole list of things we want to talk about, but these, I think, really dovetail nicely.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. So today we are going to be talking about professional judgment, decision making, and risk. Did you just say that? Did I just repeat you what you just said?
You did, but I think it's fine.
Okay. Cool. Thank you.
You can tell it's the day after a long weekend.
Yeah, we'll get it together. Hopefully we'll get it together way before the end of the podcast. All right, let's start. I think we're going to start by defining what professional judgment means, because I think it's like one of those terms, isn't it, that's kind of chucked about in practice, but I'm not sure whether there's a common definition, I guess, as to what it means. And maybe it doesn't need to have a common definition. Like maybe it needs to be just contextual. I don't know.
I think for me, like when you say that, the definition, I kind of giggled because I remember talking to a group of practitioners who were part of a service, and the service, you know, said that they were a trauma-informed service. And when I asked the practitioners to tell me what that meant for them, for their clients and their service, I was just met with crickets. And so it made me giggle thinking, I wonder if it could be the same for professional judgment. It's that word that we use, but if we're asked to define it, what do we say?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it's kind of like, and we've had this conversation, haven't we, Rose, about when someone asks you to define complex trauma. And again, it's like, oh, okay, hang on. How do I actually do that? I know that I know it, but how do I put what I know into words?
Yes, it's definitely that situation. And then your brain kind of, it's that moment where you're like, well, I'm not stupid. I do know this, but give me a minute to make this a rational thought.
All right.
So well, professional judgment, what would you say it is?
All right. So we did actually look up some definitions, didn't we? So this is just a bit of a compilation is the word I'm looking for, of just kind of different definitions that we read. So professional judgments are reasoned and ethically guided decision-making process that workers use in their practice. It involves the synthesis of knowledge, values and ethics and experience to arrive at sound judgments that promote the well-being and best interests of clients and the wider community.
Everyday language, in practice language, what are we saying?
Yeah. Well, what are we saying? How would we define that in practice language?
In practice language, I would say it is knowing the policies or procedures of the organisation you're working for. It's knowing about some theories and some having practice wisdom or practice guidance, and using your knowledge of then your client's family or your client's situation to draw upon all of those aspects, policies, procedures, you know, theories, practice wisdom, the clients, and having an ethical consideration about what am I seeing and what's next and what's my role in this. And how do I enter my client's world with all of this in a manner that they will understand?
Like it's super big, isn't it? It's huge to have all that all of that kind of going on in your head whilst at the same time trying to function in that. Because normally this is happening when you're in the middle of something. Normally, it's particularly if you work in a role where you need to make really quick decisions and you need to make them in a timely way, usually then and there on the spot, then all of that stuff that you just said has to kind of be floating in your head, and then you have to make sense of it. And I guess professional judgment for me is making sense of everything that's kind of sitting in your head that underpins your decision making. When I think about professional judgment, most of all, I think about that it really relies on the ability to really be critical. It's that critical thinking stuff. What does this all then mean?
Yes. And I think I would agree. I think one of the last bits of the definition you read out was about the wider community. And I have to say my critical thinking doesn't always extend to the wider community. In a sense, it does to you want clients to have a positive trajectory or to enable change in a more positive way. And I guess there's an impact then on the wider community. But I have to say I'm not consciously thinking necessarily all the time about working with a family or a client and then what's going to be the impact on the wider community.
You know what I find really interesting about what you just said is that when I think about, and I'm going to talk specifically about social work a little bit, but I know it's not a social work thing. This is a practice thing. One of the things that I was thinking about when you were talking about, you know, the wider community and whether you consider the wider community is that really social work practice is all about helping people to fit into community, isn't it? It's about helping them to fit into the world, which means helping them to actually fit into whatever context, societal context they find themselves.
Yes, but it's never a conscious thought to me, that part, the thinking about the impact or the well-being of the wider community. That's never a conscious thought, I don't think, in my work with clients. Absolutely, when you say that, I'm like, of course that all makes sense, but I don't have that lens in my professional judgment. I don't think when I'm thinking about clients and families and interventions, where are my ethics? Where is my knowledge base coming from? How am I operating within a particular policy or procedure or legislation? It's never a conscious thought for me. Isn't that weird?
Yeah, it's weird because I don't know if I agree with you around that, because I wonder if it's, and I'm not going to tell you about what you're thinking because honestly, your thoughts are your own. I just realized how that sounded when I said that. But I think when I think about decisions that you have made, say for young people, and I think it's about, because I've heard you talk about it, it's about an intervention needs to occur now for this young person, whether that be a safe place to live or therapy or whatever. So to kind of avoid there being, I think, repercussions in the future in terms of how they fit into society.
Absolutely.
But I've heard you have that kind of that rational flow of thoughts.
Yeah, it's just not conscious though that I'm thinking about that.
That's interesting.
Isn't that weird?
That's really weird. But I get it. I mean, I do actually agree with what you're saying in terms of, it's not like a next step. It's not like you're thinking, okay, this, if I make this decision, this will be the consequence on the person, on the family. Yeah, you don't.
On the wider community. I don't extend it to that.
No, I don't often go there either, to be fair. But I think we do. Like, I'm just kind of arguing myself into a circle now, aren't I? I don't think maybe we, I think maybe it's something that's conscious, but I think we actually do think about it. We just, it's not always a connected thought.
And I think what's interesting is part of professional judgment, there has to be an accountability element, right?
Yeah, there does. There absolutely does.
And part of the accountability, in a weird way, in a really weird contextual way, is the community, because we want people to be safe in our communities and we want people to be treated with dignity and respect in the community. And sometimes in our work, it's about helping people make better decisions that keeps other people safe in community, isn't it? And there's that level of accountability in the work we do, which kind of fits in the community like lens of it that I, you know, have really not thought about until just now.
And you know what I was thinking when you were talking, and I'm wondering whether we do a little bit of a sideline tangent conversation, is the role of accountability in decision making. and how accountability actually can influence decision making, which therefore can influence professional judgment in a way.
Yes, it's very
connected,
and the paradigm shift, hey, from accountability to outcome, and outcome or policy to,
I mean, I reckon that's a good chat to have. What do you reckon?
Dive into it.
When I think about accountability and how accountability influences practice, I automatically shift to the fact that we find ourselves in a bit of a blame society. It's not just in practice. It's not just social work. It's not just child protection. It's not just at-home care. But I think generally speaking, I think our society always needs someone or something to blame when accountability needs to be taken.
I would agree with that.
And then I think we know that social work practice or practicing generally so socially driven, like it's contextually driven, isn't it? So whatever is happening in the world and whatever is happening in the context, our context or our part of the world, is always going to influence practice. So therefore, when we think about the influence of a blame culture in a practice setting, then we can really see why accountability has taken the form that it has in terms of always making sure that you're looking after yourself and that you're covering yourself. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't do that. I'm just saying that it's kind of interesting that that's such a big thing.
And I think back to the times I've been on the witness stand in either the local court or the Supreme Court or the district court, because I've taken the stand in all the courts in New South Wales, to be honest. And that really is a large part of accountability. You're explaining your decision making, you're explaining your professional judgment, you're defending your position when you're cross-examined, oftentimes by the other party's legal representatives, and sometimes in the worst of cases when parents have represented themselves and it's kind of like free rein on cross-examining, but you're taking accountability there for the decision making that you've come to because of professional judgment. And I guess oftentimes if I think back to the times I've been in the witness stand and a judge or a magistrate, depending on what court, has made a different decision than what I have. So they've heard the evidence and on the occasions that it's happened, made a different decision. I still took accountability for my decision making because of my professional judgment. And then another professional in a different setting has made a very different decision using their professional judgment or their legislation. Probably they would argue legislation and law. But I can't recall a time I've walked away from giving evidence where a decision's gone differently to what I had thought, or someone's made a different decision and felt blamed. But I can tell you that more than on two hands, the amount of times I've been blamed by the organisation I'm employed by because of things that I've done that haven't worked out exactly as one would have hoped, or they don't look as pretty on the other end as what we'd like to share as our best practice examples. Isn't that a weird, when you think about it, in a court where there's very stringent rules of evidence, legislation, you know, principles enriched in the legislation, I can't recall the time I've walked away feeling blamed or shamed. But I can tell you I've sat in group supervisions, case reviews, serious case reviews, incident, you know, debriefings, and felt very blamed for making a decision based on my professional judgment in the moment that I've made, and it doesn't meet someone else's standards or expectations. And I felt very blamed in that situation.
And do you think that's about the fact that it's really uncomfortable now to be uncertain about something? Like, it's really uncomfortable for people. And I think about particularly people in that kind of that management role. I feel like it's really uncomfortable for them to sit with a situation that's just not certain either way, that's just not black and white.
Yeah, I don't know about that, because I've been in those management roles and I've been in senior management roles, and And I think when you think about the uncertainty, you have to be able to sit in it, because we're talking about human beings. This is not a mathematical equation where 2 + 2 = 4. This is every different client that you, you know, have an intervention with or case manage or provide therapy to, they are also different. So you cannot always apply the same practice wisdom or the same intervention and get the same results. It's impossible. And human beings, there's so much nuance to us as individuals and to families and to the systems we work in. And there's a hell of a lot sometimes we don't know about our clients. So I think sitting in uncertainty, sitting in the risk, sitting in the uncomfortable space of saying, I don't know, to me, that's part of professional judgment. We don't always have the answers, and we can't always say this intervention is going to provide this outcome. There's no way anyone knows that. So maybe it's as a community of practitioners, we maybe need to think about how we get better at sitting in the gray. And as, you know, if there's managers out there or senior execs sitting, you know, on boards of organization where there's lots of practitioners, how do we look at situations and really understand uncertainty is part of the job, and that when things maybe don't work out as intended, when we've used our best professional judgment and we've used, you know, come to a decision, if it doesn't go the way we intended, how do we make that a learning as opposed to a blaming exercise?
You're so reminding me of Arlene Munro and what Arlene Munro says, because that's exactly what she says, isn't it? She says that we have to use situations that don't go well as a definitely as a learning opportunity, as a reflection opportunity for next time we're in a similar situation. And she also kind of talks about the fact that it's actually okay to be in a situation where you're uncertain, where you're not sure what to do next, where you're not sure what decision to make. It's actually okay for that to happen. And it's kind of normal, which is what you're saying too, Rose. It's kind of normal for that to happen. And instead of feeling, I don't know, uncomfortable about it or feeling like you are somehow failing at your job or maybe not doing the best job because you don't know what to do next, maybe it's about actually acknowledging that it's okay and that it is just going to be a situation that you're uncertain about, but who can you actually seek some advice from, collaborate with, do all of those other things to increase your ability to make a decision or increase your ability to actually exercise professional judgment in the situation.
Yeah. And I like that, as opposed to you go to your next in line manager and they make a decision for you using their professional judgment, and then you're given a direction. Like sometimes I think in the rush to complete, you know, the casework journey or to complete an intervention, whatever it may be, we aren't always necessarily going at our client's pace. And sometimes we also don't want to take the time as professionals to sit in the gray and be like, it might be okay for the next couple of days if I just sit with this as things are and talk to different people and get, you know, get some advice, get some practice wisdom, maybe read something else. It's okay just to sit and think. But the accountability aspect of that for me has to be, I have to be able to articulate that to someone, whether that's my manager or someone else, that I'm, you know, this is where I am. This is how I got here. And this is my plan for resolving it. It's not just going to stay in this state, but I don't need someone to come in and just say to me, go do A, B, C, and D. That to me is not helpful, and that's not going to help me learn and increase my professional judgment.
I was also thinking you also don't need someone to come in and say, what's wrong with you? You're not doing your job, because you don't know. You don't know what the next step is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's also, I think, you know, when I think about the role of risk and I think about, you know, that link between uncertainty and risk, and I think about were a little bit risk adverse. Although I know that not everyone would agree with that. I think a lot of people wouldn't say we are risk adverse. I think people would say that we are just for getting better, perhaps as a sector, getting better at managing risk in a proactive way. I think as a sector, child protection out of home care is risk adverse, and I think that there are so many tools that have come into play to assess and manage risk that I think sometimes it takes the focus away from the fact that it takes the focus away from what you were saying before, that sometimes if you think about kind of managing in those times of uncertainty, managing your casework, managing yourself, managing a team, and not rushing to actually try and mitigate the risk, then it actually teaches you so much more than what you would have learnt if you'd have just kind of gone down the easy way.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think it's true in our client work, but I also think it's true with our professional colleagues. You know, if you think about, and I don't want to spend too much time on this, but if you think about bullying and harassment claims or workers' comp, psychological injuries, or where there's been accusations made about colleagues in the space you're working, oftentimes we apply the same risk adverse strategies to our colleagues as we do to our clients, in that organizations will put in lots of different interventions or investigations or assessments. So there's no decision needing to be made about a particular person or a particular situation. We just do lots of assessments. Lots of different people come in. We have, you know, 2-3 independent assessments because we're trying to be very risk adverse, I think, in that as well. And we've talked about parallel practice before, and I think that has a huge part to play in it.
Yeah, I agree. Completely agree. I mean, I think there's reasons why we have become risk adverse. And I think if I think about practice, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago, perhaps, let's say longer, because I was practicing 20 years ago. Let's say practice, say 30, 40 years ago, particularly practicing child protection. Well, we know that sometimes practice wasn't good. We know that decisions were made sometimes, they're still being made sometimes, that were not in the best interest of the client. And there's a reason why practice evolves, why we're continually needing to learn and continually needing to look at different tools to do our job.
Yes, but you also think about the context of practice 30 years ago.
Yeah.
You did not need a degree, certainly in New South Wales, to work in child protection out of home care. You just didn't need to have any formal qualifications. And so if you think about values and ethics just as a body of practitioners and the work that the sector has done on that in the last 25 years, that has, you know, contextually, we're so far ahead from where we were back 30 years ago. The professional nature, you know, of practitioners has also increased so much, mm-hmm. because there are now minimum qualifications you have to have, at least in New South Wales. And it was the same in the ACT when I worked there, to be able to actually be employed. So I think there's a lot of differences between practice now and then, and the professionalism, I guess, of practitioners.
Mm. Mm.
But no, I'm not going to argue that practice wasn't questionable back then, and there are still times today where absolutely practice is questionable, but how do we use that as a learning, as opposed to a blaming, you know, I'm going to get my big stick out and make you as a practitioner or a team or a manager, you know, feel really shamed.
Yeah. And I think that's where it goes back to the professional judgment and how to acknowledge the importance of professional judgment in everyday practice, and how to promote that for yourself, or how to promote that within the team that you're working.
Mm.
Because without a really strong sense of professional judgment, without just knowing that you can make a decision, and you have made decisions in the past and you can make decisions in the future that are about the best interests of the child, then I think you kind of become a little bit paralyzed in practice, and it's hard to move anywhere. It's hard to move forward.
Trying to get stuck.
Yeah, you do. Like, I just got stuck trying to talk about that. You definitely get stuck, I think. It's tricky.
It's very tricky.
All right. Let's think now a little bit about then. I don't know. Do we need to talk a little bit more about risk or the role of risk, or do you think we've covered that?
I think we've covered it, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, I think working with people is risky, isn't it? Like, yes. It's risky business working with individuals or working with families or working with people.
And I think because it's not a math equation. There's no one right answer. And I always used to say to caseworkers that I was managing, you can, you know, be in the situation where you've had to remove, you know, children from their parents, which is absolutely the last resort. And it's, you know, no one I've ever worked with has ever made that decision lightly or enjoyed that aspect of the work. What we don't ever see is what the trajectory of their life may have been had they stayed in those homes or those situations. We all absolutely know it when a child dies because of what could be said of the inaction of an agency. You'd very clear then the consequences. But when you've had to remove children from their birth family, no one has a crystal ball. You don't know what could have been, what might have been, in the news headlines the next week. No, you don't get to know that. It's all so unknown. And we need to remember that as practitioners. We don't have magic balls and we can't predict the future ever. But when things go bad, we absolutely know, and we dissect decision making, and there's a lot of accountability that takes place in that realm.
Mm-hmm.
But on the reverse end, when you've, you know, removed children, made, you know, situations sometimes a lot more complex and nuanced for children, you don't get to see maybe the positive consequences of that action or what, you know, how you may have actually saved an actual human life. You don't ever get to know that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's almost like how interesting would it be if you could, you know, see these kind of parallel lives, you know, if you make this decision, this is what will happen. If you make that decision, that's what will happen.
And there's so many negative unintended consequences and sometimes intended consequences that happen when you do remove a child from their family. Mm-hmm. And you sit then as a practitioner in all of that complexity, mm-hmm. in all of that, you know, nuanced, murky water. And it takes a lot to then work with the family, the children. We all know the outcomes educationally for children in care, the outcomes of their health needs in care. We all know all of that research and what we know about the trajectory of their lives and their outcomes for identity. You name it, we know it. But we don't ever know what would have happened had we have left them in their family of origin where they were being abused and neglected.
No, I agree with that.
And that's the risk we sit with every day.
Yeah. But I guess I was also thinking about that from a position of out-of-home care and when children are left in placements that are just not okay for them. And I guess, again, the decision to leave that child in that placement is because, well, sometimes it's because is it any better out of this placement?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I remember managing two sisters in out-of-home care, and the manager of the team and the caseworker, you know, they had done everything humanly possible, provided so many interventions in this family placement for these sisters. And this placement had been a worry and a concern for 2 years before I come to this team. And I remember it was a Thursday late afternoon, and the caseworker and the manager were like, "We cannot think of one more thing to do. Like, we think we're past the point of having a conversation about change of placement. Like, you know, this, we don't want to criticize anyone, but this should have happened months ago." And then it was a new case for this manager and caseworker. They'd had it maybe 9 months. They're like, "We changed teams to get a fresh perspective. And all we did was reinvent the wheel and offer services and interventions and ask the same questions and do the same assessments." Mm-hmm. And these little girls, they are no better off. Like, if they were with their natural parents, what would we do? And the caseworker was so adamant, "I can tell you we would have removed them. Why is it okay?" And it was about that risking, we don't have a placement for these little girls. I mean, they were in primary school. They weren't little, but in my head, you know, little. We don't have a placement for them. It's almost 5 o'clock on a Thursday. Tomorrow's Friday. We have no placement. The weekend's coming. We know the carers, aunt, uncle, they're not going to be happy about this decision. You know, it brings a whole lot of other processes into play. But I remember sitting there thinking, well, we can continue doing the same thing, which does not help these girls. We know it doesn't help. Or we can make a decision using all of our professional judgment, all of our assessment tools. We can make the best decision we can for these girls right here tonight, and we can sit with the uncertainty of not knowing where they're going to go when the caseworkers get back from the home.
Yeah.
So we did. I said, let's make the decision, and the relief from the caseworker and manager, but also the wider teams. Like, these girls had been a worry for, you know, the service system that we worked in for such a long time. Everyone knew their names, everyone knew their stories, everyone knew the amount of hours and, you know, worry that had gone into this, and this relief that actually a different decision was being made. What didn't feel good after having made this decision, and there was an instant relief, I felt like, okay, I've made this decision, and I made it based on professional judgment and knowing that this was the last resort. We had tried many, many other interventions to be least intrusive and to keep these girls in this kinship placement. So there was that initial relief of, we've made a decision. We're confident about this decision. But I did not feel that at 6:30 p.m. that night when these two little girls are running around the office with no placement. They had always lived together, and we absolutely wanted to keep them together. And there was not one single placement in the whole state that could accommodate these two girls together.
Mm.
Not one. And that's when I guess you start to think, what have we done? Have we made the right decision? How is this good for these girls that now they're separated? And they went into separate short-term crisis placements. They couldn't continue at their school, and they were in the same school because they were geographically so far away from their school. Sibling contact took the form of photos, FaceTime, phone calls, letters. It was really hard to get them to have face-to-face contact more than once a week. And these little girls were each other's best friends.
I'm assuming they probably used each other as just a safety and secure kind of.
Absolutely. And then, you know, they are, you know, their second removal first from their birth parents, then they go into this placement with aunt and uncle, and then we've removed them from that placement too. And then the work that followed in the months, you know, trying to find a sibling placement so we could have them in the one placement, the complaints that came from the aunt and uncle, the NCAT, you know, the legal action that was taken to try and have them restored to the aunt and uncle's care. And I started questioning, have we done the right thing here? Is this really best for these little girls? And I tell you, it wasn't until months later when the younger girl said to me, I did not know what fresh bread tasted like until you took us from our aunt and uncle. I always thought bread was hard and crusty, and, you know, sometimes those green spots on the bread, I just thought that was normal. And I had never slept. I can't remember, she said, I can't remember sleeping in a bed with sheets that smelt nice or being told that, you know, I was loved. She said, I had never experienced, and this was 2 years later, any of those things until I came into the placement she was in with her sister. But it took us a year and a half to find those girls a placement together, and many, many more interventions to make, you know, to make it feel like the action was justified, or the outcome of that action was actually justified. It was a long time to sit in that risk and uncertainty.
And I was going to say, I can imagine you would have had to have justified your decision a million times in that time.
a million times to NCAT, to the courts, to my supervisor, to the minister, you know, to the local MP, like the avenues of complaint, which are well warranted and needed in a system like child protection out of home care, absolutely warranted. But the amount of time, and then because they were in separate placements, it turned into not really about the girls and the abuse and neglect that they were being, you know, exposed to, or they were being abused by their aunt and uncle. It became less about that and more about, well, now you've moved them, they're not with family and they're not together. So the outcome didn't look worthwhile or justified. Mm-hmm. That's how it felt to me, at least.
Yeah, I can imagine. And how interesting when that happens, that the argument becomes not about what was actually happening for these girls and not about the reason why they were removed, but it becomes about actually blaming you and accountability and getting you to really kind of in a way cover your own ass in terms of the decision that was made.
Yeah. And it made me question my decision making, my professional, it made me question all of that. I'm sure it made my manager question that. Yeah. And I'm sure that it would have been definitely easier at different points in time to have restored them to aunt and uncle, because they could have been together. They could have gone back to their primary school. You know, the aunt and uncle would have stopped complaining. There would have been many benefits to putting them back and saying we made the wrong decision. But I wholeheartedly believe we did not make the wrong decision. It just didn't look like a good decision because they were separated. They left their schools and their sibling contact looked very different for a long time afterwards. It just didn't look good.
Mm.
But it was the right decision.
Well, and I think that's why in those situations, it's why it's so important to have a really strong sense of why the decision was made. So a really strong sense of professional judgment, really.
Yes. And I had, I did have a good manager who, after the initial stages, absolutely understood what life was like for these two little girls with their aunt and uncle. I had made sure that she met these little girls when they were in at the office. So, you know, there was this familiarity with them, or this knowing of them, that we weren't just talking about complaints or the aunt and uncle. We were actually talking and centering these two little girls. And I did feel that my then manager stepped in and she started being able to answer some of those complaints, because she knew their story too. And she knew that these little girls were actually, they were being harmed in out-of-home care. And whilst it was a family placement and they were in the local area and all of those other boxes were ticked, it didn't mean it was a good placement or a placement we should return them to.
Definitely. And I think, you know, when you said that, you know, the person who is in the decision-making role actually met the people that were making decisions for, I think that is so powerful.
Yeah, that is one thing I did a lot when I was in a senior management role. I would make sure when children or young people came to the office, if our director was in, I would take them up and introduce them.
Yeah, okay. I thought you were going to say that you always met the kids that you
watched. I always met the kids.
Yeah.
99% of the time, absolutely. I would do home visits with caseworkers, with managers. Yeah. I would attend, you know, meetings. If there was a child or young person in the office, I would go and introduce myself. I would take them to the doctors. I would do the casework aspect when caseworkers, you know, were dealing with crisis. I was always up to do that. But I also made sure I would take the children and young people up to the next level and introduce them to my director.
Maybe that's why people, and I'm just saying people, maybe me as well, I have always had such high regard for you, because you've always been such a strong and passionate advocate for the people that you work with. And I think that's what it is, because for you, it's always so relational and there's always this personal aspect.
Well, yeah, I think that is like that for everyone. That's like that for you too.
But I don't think it's like that for everyone. I don't think it is. I think for some people, I think some people become a little bit scared of kind of seeing the role as a relational role?
I don't know about that. I just know it has always made sense to me that if we're making decisions about people, especially children and young people, that I want to know these children and young people. I want them to know too that they have an avenue of complaint. So if their caseworker, you know, if things aren't going great with their caseworker, they should always know their caseworker's manager, and then they should always know the manager's manager, you know. And surely I know there were some children, young people I didn't meet when I was in a senior management position, but I met most of those children and young people. And I always made a point to show photographs to my director if I knew the kids were geographically away from the office, or they were just not the type of kids that would come and say hi in the office. Mm-hmm. I always made sure that I then had updated photos so I could talk about them and have them at the center of the discussions some way. But that's just how I've always done it.
Well, and like I said, that's why you've always, I think, been so good at your job. But I also think the people that I think are really strong, great practitioners in this field do that as well.
Yeah.
But just to reiterate what I said before, I feel like it's a little, I don't know if the work is relational as it used to be. And I don't know if that's because, well, I think there's probably lots of reasons for that. But I think some of it is probably down to accountability, and some of it's probably down to the fact that there isn't the same emphasis on professional judgment as there used to be. And I think that one of the things about getting to know the people you're making decisions for means that you generally are going to make decisions for that person that are in their best interests.
Yeah, it's much harder, I think, when you know the children and young people, much harder to make quicker decisions, or decisions that maybe seem easier in the moment than the harder ones, if that makes sense.
Makes perfect sense. Because, you know, making decisions that you know needs to be made for the best interests of the child are usually the ones that are the hardest decisions to make, because they're the ones that take the most work.
Yeah, absolutely. And you make the decision and the work somehow triples, quadruples.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I guess when I was thinking about risk, but also thinking about professional judgment, and we've talked a lot about that from a child protection out of home care lens, but I'm wondering whether we can have a chat about that from a private practice lens.
Yeah.
Because it's so very different, isn't it? Like, it's different as a private practitioner. It's kind of where you're probably sitting with uncertainty a little bit, because you only know your piece of the pie. You only know what people tell you about the person you're working with. You don't know a lot of the other contextual information because you're just not given that information. It sometimes makes it a little bit tricky, I think, in my own experience as a private practitioner, to one, feel like you've got a really true sense of the picture. And then that, for me, if I don't feel like I know all of the information, that really compromises professional judgment for me at times, or decision-making, because I feel like, how can I make a decision? How can I make the decision that you want me to make about this person when I feel like I don't have all the information, and you're not going to give me all the information because I'm a private practitioner?
Mm. Have you got an example of that?
Do you know, I think probably one of the... I think I probably have a current example, but I'm going to change a lot of the information in my story because it's so current, I guess, if that makes sense. I'm thinking about it in terms of when we have referrals for therapeutic life story work. And when the intervention is not supported by the carer, but it is pushed and pushed by the agency, and usually pushed for good reason. It's really, you know, because it's a great intervention, so it's pushed for good reason. And I think sometimes the agency can see the benefit of the intervention. And then I don't always think that that the benefit translates to the carer. And then the carer who then will just put up lots and lots of blockages,
yeah,
I guess, to actually being able to have a positive intervention. And I think those blockages, and there's one situation that I'm currently thinking about at the moment, those blockages I think are around fear, as but also around some kind of uncertainty about how is the child going to respond to this information, and is that going to place more pressure on the child, on them, on the placement. As a private practitioner, it's really tricky to be in that situation, because you can see how important this intervention would be for this child. And you could also, this child in particular that I'm thinking about, I can actually see why they need it. And they, in so many ways, they're just desperately seeking information. But then they are also so scared of that information. And I think the carer is only seeing the fear.
You know what's interesting? I have a new referral for therapeutic life story work for a sibling group. At the moment, they are all boys, all in high school, and yeah, they're with their paternal grandparents. And the agency really would like therapeutic life story work. They've been with their paternal grandparents for many years, since they were very young.
Yeah.
They don't have much contact with their father, but it's paternal grandparents, so they know his history and his story. They raised him. They're able to fill in those blanks. But their contact with their mother has been up and down over the years. She sometimes is really good at attending contact and staying in contact, and her life seems to be going okay at certain points. And then there's periods where she just is unable, I guess, to keep that level of consistency. So when I was arranging to meet with the grandparents, you know, as we do, we meet with them before the intervention starts with the young people. The grandmother said to me, I just need to be very clear. This isn't about contact with their mother. We all know what she's like. And I won't be pushed into a situation where this becomes about how mum can see the children.
Right. Yeah.
I was like, oh. You know, the agency hadn't given me any information about any plans about recommencing contact or that mum was on, like none of that. It's very early days. And I just asked some questions. You know, I think the first question I asked was, are you able to share with me why you felt the need to tell me that right now, today? Mm-hmm. She said, what do you mean? I said, well, it sounds to me like that's a non-negotiable for you and really important for you to tell me that on the very first phone call I've made. And I guess I'm wondering if you can tell me where that urgency has come from you to tell me that.
Yeah. Yeah.
She said, I just need you to know because I'm sick to death of this agency telling me that my kids have to have contact with their mother and it's always at their expense.
Mm. And I thought,
isn't that interesting?
Mm, that is.
And I said to her, I used, I guess, my professional judgment, and I made a decision that I would share with her that part of the intervention is talking about, you know, mothers and fathers and their life experiences when we have that information.
Yeah.
And that sometimes the intervention can, you know, open a space of empathy. And children can make sense about some of the decision making from their parents. And that sometimes that has led to children wanting more contact with birth family. And sometimes the reverse, but that I wasn't there to talk about contact. But there may be some unintended consequences of the therapeutic life story work intervention with her grandchildren.
Mm. What'd she say?
She didn't say much, so I continued to talk and said that we would work together, that this was a partnership intervention, and that no matter what her fears were, if we could have an open dialogue about them, we could always work on them together.
Hmm. Okay.
She,
well,
she, She agreed to meet me in a few weeks to talk further about the intervention.
Yeah.
But what I didn't want to do was not address it when she obviously had the need to bring it up on that first phone call. Like, and it was one of the first things she said to me. I needed to let her know that sometimes children do finish life story work and they want more contact with their parents, or they have more empathy, or they have more questions. And sometimes the opposite is true. Like, you just don't know how the intervention is going to impact children and young people.
Yeah, yeah.
Needed her to know that.
Yeah, yeah. God, good on you. I think that, I mean, it sounds like that was a really important conversation to have and very timely. Well, I guess in my situation with the example I was talking about, you know, I still need to do some more thinking about it because I just, yeah, I'm a little stuck in terms of what to do. So I'm going to be thinking about that one for a little bit longer. Yeah. All right, Reza, I don't know if there's much else for us to say about this topic. What do you reckon?
I think we've talked a lot about professional judgment, decision-making, risk, and hopefully highlighted that there's no perfect sequential order of casework or therapy or therapeutic interventions, and that there will be times in practice where we're unsure about what to do next, and that that is okay.
Yeah, and I guess that is the message that I really want to get across, that it's okay to feel uncomfortable because you're uncertain. It's something that kind of, I think feeling uncertain, whilst I absolutely 100% think it can paralyze you in terms of, you know, when you start to panic and you start to feel like, I don't know what to do next, so therefore I'm going to do nothing, I'm just going to stop. But I think if you can kind of work through that, it becomes such a great catalyst for learning.
I would agree with that.
Yeah. That's really what I wanted to get across. And I also wanted to get across that professional judgment isn't just something that happens. Just because you've worked somewhere for 5 years doesn't mean that you know everything or that you feel like you're across everything. Professional judgment is a process of learning that actually you have to be actively engaged in.
Yes. And I think in this area that we all work in, no one knows everything. And I don't recall a day where I haven't learnt something. We have to always be learning.
As long as you're open to learning. And that's, I think, part of my, when I pretend that I'm 80 and I'm looking back and I'm like, oh, the worries for the young. One of my worries for the young is that I think there's, I don't know if there's always the openness for learning that there used to be. And I don't even know if what I'm saying is true or if it's just my own generalized thought. But that does concern me because I think if you don't learn and if you are not just kind of embarking on this learning journey every single day you're at work, then you're just going to be the practitioner you are today. You're going to be the same person in 10 years' time. And is that going to be okay?
Yeah. I think that's why we also worry a lot about AI, isn't it? Like, how much reliance do we see now in the field on AI? And don't get me wrong, AI is an amazing tool.
Yeah.
But it is just that. It is one tool of many tools we should be using.
Yeah.
Because the actual practice, working with other human beings, it cannot be done artificially.
No, I agree. It is a great tool, but yeah, it can't be done artificially. And I guess one of the ways that I kind of get a little worried too is about social work education. And I know this is broader than social work, but just the education, like what are the tools? What knowledge are people bringing into practice? And is that actually okay? And is that up to scratch? Yeah, I don't know.
It's a big topic, probably. Discussion for a much later day.
Yeah, I agree. All right, let's wrap up. I just wanted to thank you all for listening to Relational Practice of Social Work podcast. Please follow us on Facebook and Instagram and hit follow on wherever you are listening so other practitioners can find us. Please come back in 2 weeks' time for another fantastic episode.
Yeah, thank you guys for listening, and until next time, stay safe and continue to practice relationally.